Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Damage Report here under lockdown. It is a big news day, so it makes sense that we're joined by someone big on the news. Michael Shore, how's it going?
It's going well. You know, as a lifelong Genesis fan, I love your theme song. It's very Genesis-y, very sort of, you know, new drum machine.
Yeah.
Synthesizer, Mellotron-y. Yeah, I like it.
I like that description of it better than JR, who always starts singing My Sharona, because apparently it shares a similar progression.
Oh, that's interesting. Anyway, it's not very Knacky. It's more Genesis-y to me.
I'll take that. Well, very glad to have you here, because it is a big news day. I mean, we're going to be talking about primary challenges. We're going to be talking about, you know, chaos in the streets. There's so much that we aren't going to be talking about. I mean, you were just telling me before the show about these buildings being swept into the ocean by a landslide. We've got videos of brutality, you know, in New York, while Cuomo is saying the cops have never hit a peaceful protester with their batons. Like, it's a chaotic country. And so I'm glad that we're able to touch base. If you have already joined the chat, as many of you have, please hit the like button. It lets people know that the stream is active, and you can, of course, engage with us in a variety of ways, including tweeting at us at hashtag TDR Live, commenting, super chats, and taking part in the conversation over twitch.tv/TYT. Some people are already sending super chats. Matthias said, your splash screen was prescient. So we have, it's sort of like a joke, is that our, like, branding for the show is, like, the White House is on fire and everything's chaotic. It now seems like a bit of an understatement. But anyway.
Reporting the damage, John. Huh? And exactly. That's right in the title.
That's what we're doing. By the way, William Emerson sent in Snapchat, a super chat saying, we love epic politics, man.
Oh, so, thank you, William. That's it's nice to hear. Nice to hear early, you know.
Exactly. Rob Shively says, I understand the Genesis love, but I think I've always been more of an SNES fan. Me too, actually, growing up. Anyway, that was fun. But we have a lot to get to, and we want to fit it all in. So, Michael, why don't we jump right to the news? New York could have another exciting primary battle brewing in the very near future. We've got Elliot Engel, current incumbent, caught on a hot mic, appearing at an event to talk about what's been going on in the country and maybe revealing a bit more than he intended to.
Then I gotta go down the list, and it's just too many folks here.
So, Michael, what do you think? I mean, what? Showing up during two simultaneous crises and implying, like, I mean, I wouldn't even be here if I didn't have to pretend. Have a prime.
Yeah. He thinks that that's funny. And therein lies the disconnect. And, you know, in a tongue-in-cheek way, that's something you could say to your staffer and say, if I didn't have a primary, I wouldn't have to be dealing with this right now, because members of Congress do not like getting primaried. It's a hassle. It's a lot of money to spend. They're going to have to spend on a general election. Generally speaking, it's very difficult to raise money as an incumbent member of Congress who does not have a close race, but you have to then go out and raise money for a primary. But again, this is what people are talking to when they say that there is a lackadaisical, a disinterested, an older generation of politicians whose time has come. And that's why they primary within the party. I'm not always in favor of it just to do it. But this is a case where you understand that there is an entrenchment that is really just too strong.
So you believe he is joking there? That he's, I mean, not being like, I'm just so frustrated. I come all the way out here, and now you're saying I can't speak, or I can't speak for as long as I want.
You know, I think that there. Listen, I think he means it, but I also think that there is some tongue in cheekness to it when he says it. And I'm not just giving Elliot Engel the benefit of the doubt. I don't know anything to Elliot Engel, but I do know that people speak in that way. You know, that there's, I wouldn't have slept all the way out here if I didn't have to. You know, and now I'm not even getting a chance to speak. So I think there was a little annoyance, but I also think that that has been sort of a thematic way of talking about these things among them, many members of Congress. And I don't mean a joke like you're going to be rolling on the floor laughing, but it's like, you know, John.
I was not.
Yeah. No, no, but I mean, that's not that kind of joke that I'm
saying. I get what you're saying. Jamal Bowman certainly wasn't. He tweeted in response to this, this is incredibly painful to watch from Representative Elliot Engel. It hurts. We need to be taking care of our communities right now, whether it's election season or not. It's clear that we need new leadership in New York 16. And exciting news coming out last night with a popular politician in the region, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, saying this moment requires renewed and revitalized leadership across the country and at the ballot box. She's going to have new endorsements coming out tomorrow, but as of last night, she's endorsing Jamal Bowman.
She's not just popular congresswoman. She's now a colleague of Elliot Engel. So that makes it even bigger. But... Yeah, no, I know. But I think it's important to underscore that for precisely the same reasons I was just talking about. She is saying we don't need this sort of tired leadership.
Yeah.
And she's a colleague. She is part of the same, not just a colleague in Congress. She is a part of the same state delegation. These sorts of things are usually unprecedented. You don't see it very often. And I think especially with someone in leadership in terms of a committee chairman. So I do think it's important to talk about the political story behind this, not just the campaign story, because it really does matter.
Yeah, yeah, it is rare. I mean, it's making big news because she doesn't do tons and tons of endorsements, and certainly not against incumbent Democrats. But I mean, we should point out that while it is very rare, it's not necessarily the case that it needs to be very rare. This is a primary. She's not endorsing a Republican challenger to Elliot Engel. She has no obligation to pretend that simply because someone else shares a party label with her that they are fundamentally the same on a wide range of issues, particularly in this case, foreign policy with Elliot Engel. Jamal Bowman is much more closely ideologically aligned with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And while she wants Democrats to outnumber Republicans, she also wants more people like her inside of the Democratic caucus. And you're not going to get that if you simply accept that anyone who's already in a position, that it's entirely illegitimate to ever challenge that. And so I'm glad that selectively, she's not just willy-nilly, endorsing literally anyone. She's choosing her battles. But this one, particularly with Bowman raising a lot of money recently, it seems like a possible win for progressives coming up in a few weeks.
Yeah, it does. And I think it's really important what you just said too, John, is that, it doesn't have to be that way. But this is just the kind of old guard politician that you would have thought would have sort of not taken. And I don't know this to be fact. So I'm speaking, extemporaneously here, guessing that he fits the mold, Elliot Engel, of the type of politician that didn't take Ocasio-Cortez as seriously as some of the others did. He said, oh, this is just a fact in politics right now. So it would stand to reason that that's the type of politician she would stand up to, but she is standing up to on the grounds that she really does agree with Bowman more than she would with Engel. And it is a brave thing to do for Ocasio-Cortez too. I mean, it's not easy going against your party whoever it is. Republicans found it with Steve King, though some of them did finally do that. And he is the most obviously out there polar opposite of everyone in Congress or most people in Congress.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a weird move by AOC considering that she's just, she just does whatever Nancy Pelosi wants and she's learned to play the game and she's been beaten down by the machine on the inside and she was fake the whole time. Oh, sorry. I've been reading too many editorials, I think. But anyway, it's a good move. And by the way, if anyone watching this would like to see a little bit more of Jamal Bowman and his platform, he's been on the Damage Report a couple of times, including just a few weeks ago in the run-up to this primary, so that is available on the channel if you'd like to take a look.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Video is going viral this morning of an individual yelling at cops after his car had been shot at. He gets out and yells about the fact that his pregnant wife is in the vehicle, and take a look at how the cops respond. I wanted to play some of that because we can't show all of the videos that we see all the time. I mean, there's the video of the biker being chased down the street by cops trying to, you know, hit him with clubs. But I want people to be reminded that this is weirdly casual violence. That the cops are just standing on the corner, the guy's yelling at him, so they light up his car. He's not doing anything, he's not a threat. They just light it up. And they know that all this is being filmed. This is day 4, day 5 of the protest. They've seen that all these acts end up getting out. And so they're doing it knowing that they'll be filmed and not caring, believing that they will be absolutely fine, that there will be no consequences. And I'm starting to wonder if there will be. I've seen a few cops that have been identified from particular videos that have been fired, but for the most part, the brutality doesn't seem to have any career consequences for them.
And these are the people that are so irate over the looting that seems to be going on, thinking, you know, as if no one is watching, rampaging in the streets. They're decrying it at every turn. But it's actually no different at all. And it's worse because it's certainly far more violent than the looting that's going on. But it's happening in the same way. Those two stories are exactly alike. What the police are doing, thinking no one's watching because everyone is distracting, is the same thing as someone knocking the glass out of a window of a store and taking things out of it because nobody is watching.
Yeah. And there's a video of this like massive military truck that should not be deployed in the streets of the U.S. And they're yelling at protesters, "Move or you will be dead." Knowing that they're filmed, they don't care. There's a video going around this morning of a woman and the cop. It looks like is groping her. He would probably say he was trying to restrain her. She, in response to her breasts being grabbed, fights free of the cop and then stands, arms down, stands as she's surrounded by cops that begin beating her with billy clubs. She's not fighting back. She's not swinging her arms. She's not running.
You see what I mean? I mean, this is the exact same thing. They're doing what the looters are doing. They think nobody's watching. And even if someone is watching, they don't care that people are watching.
Yeah. Yeah, these are protests around police brutality, and they seem to think, we should prove their point. Like they believe one of two things, that it's fine to turn gradually day by day virtually everyone against them, or they think that there's enough people out there that no matter how many videos of this sort of brutality you have, they will still be on the side of the cops. They seem to have made that decision. They're not the only ones. Trump and many other Republicans seem to have made the same decision. But then you have the misinformation around it. I mean, you know, the most popular cable news channel is Fox News. They're not going to acknowledge any of this. If you watch that for your news, you're not going to know any of this happens. And then you're going to have people like Governor Cuomo saying that this doesn't happen. Cops don't actually hit people with their clubs. So they get to cover their eyes and pretend that none of this is going on.
Okay. That's exasperating.
It is. And like I said, we can't show them all. It would be the whole show, day after day. But some of them, like, ugh. Senator Tom Cotton had an op-ed recently you might have seen going around. Tom Cotton, send in the troops, in the New York Times. I read that it was on the 31st anniversary of Tiananmen Square. I could be wrong about that, but it seems appropriate. And that op-ed has generated a lot of controversy, reactions from people working at the New York Times, particularly when you understand who Tom Cotton is and what he has said about these protests already. Tom Cotton had previously tweeted that whatever it takes to restore order should be done, no quarter for insurrectionists, anarchists, rioters, and looters. Now, of course, technically, no quarter means that we will not be taking prisoners. We will be killing people instead of taking them prisoner. He's a soldier, so one would think he'd know that. He tried to pretend afterward that that's not what he meant, but that is what that means. And you would expect that either a soldier or a senator or someone who is both would be a little bit more careful with their language. But I personally think that he was being careful with his language. I think he knows that his base loves that sort of talk. And so the same
thing. But I don't know that everybody understands that. I think a lot of people think it means no space. I will give no space to these people. But it does literally mean what you said. And he should have used better words than that because he knows, even if other people don't.
Yeah. And so you have Tom Cotton saying that. I don't know if that's better or worse than Matt Gaetz saying that now Antifa should be hunted down the way we hunt down Al Qaeda. Take your pick. But neither of them have suffered any consequences. You can just imply that protesters should be murdered in the streets and it's okay. Should we be using
drones?
Well,
Gaetz got a warning on his tweet. He got a warning on his tweet. Is that
That's true. Oh, yeah. That's true. That's enough. We don't need anything more. And then he wore that as a badge of honor. His first, I would guess. But anyway, Tom Cotton had that op-ed where he calls for soldiers to be dispatched across America to put down these sorts of things. He has a comment in there, by the way, about the fact that America is not blind to injustice, but yada, yada, yada. What I noticed was in these tweets and in that op-ed, although we're not blind to injustice, he gave no acknowledgement of any of the virtue or value of any of these protests or the rage that's driving them. He acknowledged no need to reform the police that I saw. He had no legislation that he plans to put forward to make sure that these sorts of killings, like the killing of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and a number of others, Ahmaud Arbery, there's developments on that story today, need to be changed. All he had, the only suggestion he had, was to deploy soldiers to put down the protests. And a lot of people had a problem with that. We're going to have some of that in a second. But Michael, what do you think about all this?
You know, it's tough. I'm not reflexively opposed to them printing this, but I've learned a little bit over the past day of reading what other people's reactions are to it. The op-ed is controlled by the op-ed editorial board. That's their job. It's divorced from the paper to some degree, but too many times people who already have a platform, you have to expect they get nearly 1,000 submissions every day to be on the op-ed page, and they give them too often to people.
Is that a guess? Do they really get 1,000 a day?
I would imagine they get between 500 and 1,000 every day. I don't know that. And that's something that that could probably be gotten from them. But they get hundreds, certainly. I know that because I know somebody worked at the Times when I was trying to get something in myself once. And they said, you don't have a shot. And this was I was in like just after college. And that was then. So I would imagine they get very many. The point, though, is that they give them too often to people who already have a platform. Tom Cotton has one in the Senate every day, and you kind of know his position. But on the First Amendment score, I think that it's important, to not pick and choose. At the same time, I think there are limits. I think that we all have this instinctive knowledge that fascism, as it's sort of laid out here without saying that word, is wrong. And what does the time gain? What are the times gained by that? Also, Tom Cotton is a senator who is up and coming. He is presidential fodder when you ask Republicans about him. He also has the president's ear. And I think it's important to know what's going on, what's coming out of the mouth that has the president's ear. So I'm a little torn. I don't think the Times should have run it, but I also see what they're doing and why they did and what would have happened had they not run it. Had Tom Cotton, which doesn't matter to me, but it does matter to the Times, had Tom Cotton said, I had this op-ed that the Times refused to run, here it is, and this is why the Times is bad, and this is why the media is bad. I sort of see they were in a tight spot, too.
I get what you're saying. I have a feeling Tom Cotton will be saying that anyway. I don't think that...
He already has, like you said, John. He's been saying it, right? Yeah. This is nothing new, so I hear what you're saying.
Well, and...
It's a prevailing sentiment, though, and there are people on that side of the argument that agree completely with Tom Cotton. Is it important to hear that? Yeah,
I get what you're saying. Yeah. In terms of the like trying to not be seen as biased, it is a pointless war to engage in because the right doesn't care. They're not expressing an honest opinion that these sources are biased against them. They're gaming the refs. That's all it is. And so you're never going to appease them.
That's a good point. Yeah.
And in terms of what would, I mean, I know he would complain if it hadn't been published, but it isn't like senators don't get op-eds published all the time. Was it Schatz, I think, who he said, I submitted one on climate change, one on Medicare. They didn't print either of those.
Right.
He's a senator. Aren't we obligated to hear what he has to say? That's what a lot of people had said. But they didn't publish them because, as you point out, there are many possible submissions. They could have run an op-ed about the need to defund the police. Maybe they'll do that, especially now after this controversy. But they ran this.
I think also just to finish your thought there is that you have to listen to how it was, who was receiving it poorly, which I didn't do initially when I said, oh, they've got to print it. It's free press and yada, yada. Black America feels like it endangers them. And I think the Times has to listen to that and has to respect that. And that's maybe something they would do next time because of the outcry and because of what a sensitive time this is to print that. Maybe do it in 3 months. Looking back, I would have used Tom Cotton would have used military strength. I think it's not just easy to do this, but I've learned a lot from the reactions of Black America on this, that it endangers them. And I don't think that's the Times' role at all.
Exactly. Yeah, they rightfully fear that if there are soldiers on the streets of perhaps New York specifically, we see what's happening, that the violence is extreme, that it is disproportionate, that it is distributed unequally based on the race of individuals. I mean, you've probably seen multiple videos of there were store owners, Black store owners, who called the cops to help them with looters. And the store owners got arrested. In this particular case, I'm thinking of they weren't beaten, at least, but they were arrested. And so a number of employees of the Times are saying that. Here you have, I'll probably get in trouble for this, but to not say something would be immoral. As a Black woman, as a journalist, as an American, I am deeply ashamed that we ran with this. Running this puts Black New York Times writers, editors, and other staff in danger. A number of employees had that same basic message. And the editorial page editor for New York Times responded with a thread. One of the tweets in that thread was, we understand that many readers find Senator Cotton's argument painful, even dangerous. We believe that is one reason it requires public scrutiny and debate. And the thing is, it perhaps gets to be for him, maybe, I don't know, or for me, a sort of intellectual thing, the duking out of ideas, but it's not my life on the line.
And right, so, well, and that's what changed my mind too. I agree with you.
Yeah. So what, yeah, I mean, Trump in his speech earlier this week made a reference to the Second Amendment. We know what he's saying. So if Tom Cotton's op-ed was, good patriotic white Americans need to arm themselves and protect their property, would they run that? And there has to be a line somewhere.
And there has to be fact checking by the op-ed board, too. I mean, because there were so many wrong proposals pronouncements in that op-ed. And it should also be pointed out that James Bennett, who is the editorial page editor, is the brother of Senator Michael Bennett of Colorado. I think it's, there is a Senate connection there as well.
Interesting. See, that's what we need from you. And by the way, people are acknowledging that. On Twitch, Upermeg says, Michael does give perspective I usually don't see, think of. Annoying as it gets, though. But he does like having his horizons broadened there.
I'm not here to annoy. I'm just, I've struggled with it myself, so I'm being honest about it. If my conclusion is annoying, I can't help that. But I've concluded that they shouldn't have run it. But I see the merits on both sides.
Yeah, and I try to too. What's the point of discussing something like this if you only understand it from one perspective?
Yeah.
And why have two people do that? That seems fun. Anyway.
But I mean, we're also journalists and we're reporters. And there is something infringing upon it at its very core to say you shouldn't publish this. Mm-hmm. But it's also just an op-ed. And that's why I think fact-checking it is a really important thing they need to do. Yeah. Because this was an irresponsible op-ed as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know. Maybe I'm... my last op-ed that I submitted to The Hill was rejected. It was laying out all the dangerous statements from Fox News that I believe increased the likelihood that coronavirus would spread. It was just references to things they'd said on air, and they didn't run it. And I'm still incredibly frustrated about that because People, I know that we're not day-to-day paying a lot of attention to it, but like more than 1,000 people died 2 days ago from coronavirus. About 1,000 died yesterday. It is still a very big deal. The Republicans seem to believe that the only response to these protests is to have overwhelming force to dominate the streets, and we're seeing that happening right now. As of Monday morning, let alone today, 17,000 National Guard troops have been deployed to 23 states and Washington, D.C. No state has requested federal assistance, however, subverting the normal process for domestic military intervention. I expect that to be a trend that continues. And we know that earlier this week, there was a call leaked to the Washington Post where the Secretary of Defense told governors that the National Guard stands ready to assist and urge states to dominate the battle space of any protests that had turned violent. Three unnamed Pentagon senior officials told the Daily Beast that despite this call, they had not expected the president to act on it. They said Esper spoke mainly as a show of support to the president and had not expected a further deployment of troops. Which, Michael, brings to mind for me when the military brass gave Trump a bunch of different options for Iran, and they only put out the most extreme one to make the others seem more appealing. And then they were surprised by his choice. But anyway, Esper apparently didn't really mean it about dominating the battle space. And that looks like what they're doing, though.
Yeah, it's certainly what they've tried to do. And even as he's walked it back a little bit, Esper, the intent was clear. And I don't think anybody thinks that they were mincing words about that. And they got the words out that they wanted to use. Battle space. Protests turn violent. Mm-hmm. It's not the protests themselves that were turning violent. And the looting that came out of them was not related to the protests, nor was it at first anyway violent looting. It was destructive and it was vandalizing and it was terrible. But it had nothing to do with a battle space that they tried to frame. And, you know, would this have happened if it were not an election year? I don't know, but I do think that there is some difference to the fact that that the president's up for election in less than 5 months now. So I think that you can't discount that.
And, you know, that theory could potentially explain this other turn. Trump has apparently asked for detailed information on the kinds of military vehicles, including tanks, that could be deployed, according to Pentagon officials speaking with the Daily Beast. But a senior administration official said this didn't necessarily mean Trump wanted to send tanks. The Beast reported, quote, "I think that's just one of the military words he knows," according to the official.
Oh, my God.
Which is reassuring.
Right.
But he doesn't mean tanks. It's just he sees a cat and he points and says, "Puppy." That's just the word he knows.
Right.
Imagine being a military official.
And also that there's nothing, even if forgetting the words, like the notion that he cares about it, he didn't mean that. Like he's just sitting around doing inventory? That's one of the things that he's taking control of.
He does inspections.
Yeah, right. I mean, come on.
Oh, my God. And the thing is, like, okay, I'm sure you're comfortable, senior administration official, that he doesn't actually mean it. He's just using one of the seven words he's mastered in the English language. Except that, how many times has Trump indicated that he wants tanks and rocket launchers at military parades? And we know that decades ago, he was talking glowingly about the Chinese crushing of the Tiananmen Square protests. Like that symbolic, iconic moment that we all understand what that one individual represents. All of us, except for Trump, who saw that as, hey, that guy has to get out of the way. That's an awesome parade. Move out of there, man.
And by the way, the tank did try and get out of the way of the guy, too.
Mm-hmm,
which is different than what we're seeing on the streets of the United States. So to the Chinese credit there, if you're going to give any, I mean, the whole idea was this evasion, which made it so compelling, was this lonely voice there. Yeah. But it wasn't like they just ran him. I mean, well, they didn't run him over with the tank.
Yeah. Yeah. I was predicting days ago that he's going to do it, at least in D.C. He's been horny for tanks in the streets this entire time. He's going to get it. They buzz the people with the helicopter. And look, at a certain point, this is just wordplay. I mean, you've seen some of the vehicles, I'm sure, that they're deploying. They're not technically main battle tanks, but it's basically the same thing. These are armored vehicles deployed against U.S. citizens. And so, but I would not be surprised if he was putting pressure on them to bring out even heavier hardware.
No, there's this, you know, the old, you know, a president at war is a president that's hard to defeat at the ballot box. And it just so happens this president's war is the one that he seems to fancy is here on his own soil. And so having this military presence in his mind, I am certain he did not tell this to me, nor has anyone, but it's very easy to infer that this is part of the strategy here is to be a president at war and to be right as far as the people that are going to support him would view it. So I think that's part of it as well.
Yeah, look, last thing on tanks for me, I obviously don't want any of this because the more force that they put in the streets, the more violence ends up getting unleashed on peaceful protesters. But I also know that Trump has apparently for months now just been moonlighting as the star of Democratic ads. We're going to have an ad later on. He's just doing whatever it takes to make devastating campaign ads against him. So does he not get that if he puts tanks in the street, there are going to be tank man moments that people aren't going to take the opportunity to stand in front of these tanks and force the tanks to make a decision? I mean, it's going to happen.
Right. If he doesn't know the names of any other military equipment, tanks are the only thing he can put in the street, though, John.
That's true. Trump, for the past few days, has been trying to reassure his fans that he was not, as the media reported, rushed to a bunker over the weekend because of the protests around the White House. He just went there coincidentally to inspect it. He was checking the drapes, I guess. Except it turns out that was not the case. Apparently, he was actually rushed there Friday evening, not during the day, Brian Kilmeade, but during the evening, after protesters began dismantling a temporary barricade outside the building, despite his claims that he was just inspecting it. So he did actually do that. That actually happened. But he has come up with a new idea, because the criticism from many people on social media calling Trump Bunker Boy now is that he fled from the White House down to a bunker, which he won't have to do anymore because he has decided to turn the entire White House into a bunker. Take a look at this. We all sort of expected this would come at some point. Right. What do you think?
And Mexico's paying for it too.
Now are they? Yeah, I'm sure they'd probably be happy to in this case.
I look at this from afar, right? And I look at this president is so afraid of looking weak, and what this shows about the president is that there is great weakness there. I also feel like this is the reason the Democrats should hold a convention of some sort, because I think if 5 days later the Republicans are going to have a convention after the Democrats don't, they're going to point out the fear and the weakness on the part of Democrats for not going and having their convention because of this hoax of a disease. So in some way, shape, or form, this is how he likes to define things and define people. It's about Sleepy Joe. It's about Sleepy Jeb. It's or low energy Jeb. Mm-hmm. This is weakening the other side. Here he looks weak, and he has. I mean, he is the president who was taken to a bunker and has tried to convince people that he wasn't. There is this hunkering down and this bunkering down that's going on in the White House that really shows that there is a scared president here.
Yeah. Yeah. And I wonder, like, to me, it seems like the cherry on top of the chaos cake, that Donald Trump in office leads to chaos in every area, public health, the economy, everything. And him having to, perch on the barricades inside the new White Castle that we're going to have, which, by the way, he would love to hole up in a White Castle. But anyway, I'd love every word of that. But anyway, do you think that Republicans will see it as, we get to defend our man, like that he's being besieged, now we need to help him? Could that be seen as strength? To me, it looks like incompetence leading to him huddling behind a wall. Will they see it differently?
Well, I think that the wall that exists of support for Trump is starting to show some fissures. So he's putting in another wall. I mean, if we want to push the symbolism a little bit, you have Republicans who have now started being slightly more vocal. They're not heroes for being this way at all. I'm not trying to make it that way. But it is worth noting that you have Republicans like Ben Sasse, Lisa Murkowski, who said she's struggling as to whether or not to even support the president in 2020, understands and agrees with Mattis that it was a long time before people said that. So he has to fortify in some way if his main fortification, which is support in Congress, is starting to weaken. And I think obviously that's pushing this the metaphor a little bit, but it's really true. I think that it's very important to note that the president is scared of fortifications breaking on a border, in Congress, and in front of the White House.
Yeah, and really fast, I get what you're saying about the conventions, but the thing is, like, it would be incredibly dangerous, obviously, I
agree. It's August. I don't know everything about it, but everything I do know makes me agree with you 1,000%. Yeah. But I'm just, you know, I'm looking at the politics of it, right? I'm forgetting the health for a moment, but this is what I predict they will do. And this is why there has to be some kind of representation, whether it's not having everybody there, but, you know, having your main people in one place spread apart with fewer guests and fewer delegates and voting remotely and
maybe
doing
a unified
something.
Speaking venue or something like that.
It can't be a Zoom convention as well.
Yeah. Yeah, and the thing is, like, I already know exactly how the news is going to go. The Republicans are going to cram into the Taj Mahal or something, I don't know. And then 3 weeks later, we're going to find out that 300 of them have coronavirus as a result of it. And
right.
It won't matter because nothing matters. Like, every one of these events we've predicted would lead to people getting infected. We find out 3 weeks later they were infected, and then the world moves on because nothing matters.
Because nothing at all matters.
Yeah.
By the way, I should point out, when you said White Castle, you actually meant a White Castle. And I was thinking, I wouldn't mind being holed up in a White Castle. But I was thinking of the burger place.
No. So I was thinking of the burger place.
Oh, you were.
He's a lover of burgers. But he'd love the fact that it is a White Castle.
Right. Okay. That's fine.
Do they have a blonde castle? This year has already seen multiple extrajudicial murders of unarmed black individuals in the streets, rightly identified as lynchings. And in fact, there have been updates on some of those cases recently. Once again, there has been an attempt to outlaw this practice. But understand that since at least the year 1900, members of the House and Senate have tried to pass a law making lynching a federal crime. The bills were consistently blocked, shelved, or ignored. I saw one reference to at least 200 separate attempts to outlaw this practice, but there was always something to block it. Always something. And it turns out that right now there is something as well. Because while the House has already passed an anti-lynching legislation, which is waiting approval in the Senate, on Wednesday, Senator Rand Paul told reporters he has concerns about the bill, which he said might allow some minor altercations to be punishable as lynchings. He was quoted as saying, "Bruises could be considered lynching. That's a problem. To put someone in jail for 10 years for some kind of altercation." And so he's just worried about the extent of the legislation. That's why he is the lone person apparently standing to stop this from finally becoming outlawed.
Yeah, there's a museum now in Montgomery, Alabama, that Brian Stevenson with the Equal Justice Initiative opened. It's a museum of lynching, and they chronicle every lynched man or woman and child in American history there. And it is an extraordinarily moving experience. There's nobody there who's there with a bruise. There's nobody there who is there because there was some sort of red tape that they got through to be in the Museum of Lynching. I think it's like pornography when Chief Justice, I think it was Potter Stewart, but I'm probably wrong, said that he doesn't know it. He knows it when he sees it, but he can't define it. You can define lynching. It's pretty clear what it is. And Rand Paul is so wrong on this. And he's so wrong at a time where being wrong on this is so vitally egregious. It's just incredible that he's continuing this charade.
Yeah, it seems like, I mean, look, he's the sort of, I'll just say, he's the sort of a-hole who would do this at any time. But it certainly seems like an extra level to do it now, to say, no, we're not going to finally, after far more than a century, make good on this. Now, I have problems with the language. And so, you know what? We just don't have time. And as of
right now, he's not even a lawyer, by the way. He's an eye doctor, right?
He's not even a lawyer.
He doesn't have the standing to say, well, there's some legal parts of this. We don't want to misconstrue a bruise here. This isn't foreign aid to Bulgaria without some quid pro quo. This is about anti-lynching. It's pretty clear the spirit of this bill. It's so important that this thing pass.
Yeah. And it might be one thing if it was like the person who was holding it up over a particular language thing was someone who had a long reputation and credibility built on concern around this issue. He's not that individual. And right now, if he holds it up right now, in order for the Senate to quickly pass the House bill, they would need to agree to it unanimously and without offering amendments, which he's pushing for. Adding an amendment would require the full vote of the Senate. It would mean that the bill would have to be sent back to the House for additional consideration, a move that would delay the passing of the bill because the House is currently out of session. Now, we've been perfectly fine delaying it for over a century. Seems like we could finally stop that. And also, and look, that obviously makes him look bad, because if he delays it and then it finally gets sent, we'll have to wait for the House to come back. But the House is out. That's insanity. I mean, even if there weren't these protests going on, they're gonna wait weeks and weeks before taking up the next coronavirus relief bill. 40 million people are still out of work. 1,000 people are dying every day. And the House, like, we can't expect anything out of Mitch McConnell. But the House, Nancy Pelosi seems perfectly happy to just go and fundraise a little bit. Maybe give a little speech, hold up a Bible, a little viral moment to sting Trump. They should be providing a counterpoint to the lack of leadership from the White House and from the Senate. And they're not doing that.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to explain it. This is not a defense of it. This is an explanation of it. Very often you have moments in politics, which election years are all about politics, where you just let the other side decompose. And I think that that's what they see happening when you see the poll numbers, when you see the reaction to the president from within his own party, and you just let the fire burn on that side. I agree. Obviously, more should be being done. They seem, the members of Congress that I've spoken to, all of whom were Democrats over the past week, seem pretty confident that when they get back in July, they're going to be able to have a whole lot of meat to go after this administration and the Senate on. It's a tactic. It's not one that I necessarily agree with, or certainly you or most of our audience would, but it's certainly a tactic, and they think it's going to work politically. That's all they care about this year, is getting him out.
Yeah. We'll see what's left of the country by the time he's gotten rid of, hopefully. I totally agree with your read of the politics. I'm 100% sure that that's what they're doing. I think that that's Biden's strategy too, although Biden has been more outspoken than Schumer or Pelosi recently.
But well, Schumer and Pelosi did write a letter reacting to what the president said the other day. Those are statements. They're not actions. And I don't know what actions they can take. Everything that's going on right now is really governors and mayors and chiefs of police for the most part.
The Lincoln Project, as Jared Jackson pointed out on Twitter, is just home run after home run. Awful people probably disagree with them on everything, but their ads are something. Take a look at this.
When Donald Trump came out of hiding this week, he didn't do it to bring us together or heal the nation. He wasn't there to offer words of calm and comfort. Instead, he became what we always feared, evoked the worst of our past, threatened our governors and states. He ordered our own soldiers who fought in Iraq and Afghanistan to flood the streets, instructing them to turn against Americans. Used churches and the Holy Bible as political props. He didn't invoke the Lord to give us wisdom, but to boost his polls. Ordered an attack on unarmed protesters using gas, rubber bullets, and flash grenades. Washington transformed into a war zone for this coward. This is a time for choosing. America or Trump?
Okay, Michael. So we've talked about a few of their ads. They're very talented at getting under the skin of the Republicans they target. And while obviously that's a sort of general argument against Donald Trump and where he's led America, it also is honing in on a few of the things that we know has really angered him recently. The coverage of the fact that he was, in the bunker. They call him a coward. They talk about him coming out of hiding. It seems very well suited to anger him at the very least.
Yeah, not to mention the subtlety of calling themselves the Lincoln Project, taking Lincoln away from the Republicans who try and use it, including the president. The party of Lincoln, Mike Pence, always refers to the party of Lincoln. And now the Lincoln Project is saying, guess what, Abe is not, or Donald's not Abe. This is an effective set of ads, and it'll have a cumulative effect of some kind because so many Republicans are behind it and are seeing it. And that with also the sort of the what they hope to be a bipartisan group of former presidents lined up around ads like this is going to be an important part of the optics of 2020.
Yeah. And by the way, I can see from the comments that most of the people watching this think, again, it was a very effective ad. There's this group. There's also is it Republican Voters Against Trump or something like that? They had an ad. It was like American Massacre or something like that a day or two ago. And it is weird that the vast majority of the most emotionally resonant ads coming out are made by Republicans attacking Donald Trump. I don't know why the Democrats seem to be having so much trouble matching that. Joe Biden has had some good ads. There's, from my point of view, needless fear-mongering about China in there. He seems to think he needs to appeal to people who feel like we're being too soft on China. So him and Trump are now sort of competing on that. I don't like that necessarily. But effective ad. What I'm curious about is, I've been looking at recent polling. I know that you're familiar with it. We've seen that in the public polls over the past few months, the gap, at least right now, between Biden and him has been growing up to 8 or 10 points, 11 points in one poll that I saw. So that's the public polling. In response to that, Trump said that he has polls that show him winning, but apparently he doesn't, because according to reporting and private polling conducted by his campaign, the president is well behind Mr. Biden. Those are in his, actually.
Internal polling always favors the internal poller, right? Mm-hmm. So every candidate from every office who has enough money to poll and do their internal polling will always give you numbers that are better than the ones that come out in the public polls. It helps the campaign. It helps the candidate. That Donald Trump is talking about this in such a way as, or his people are talking about it in such a way as their internal polling has him in a precarious place. That's incredible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, I try not to focus on any of these too much because it's still 5 months and you never know if the polls can move that far just over the past two months. They can theoretically move back. Although I did see, I think it was Dave Weigel had tweeted out, for the last four presidential elections, he had the Real Clear Politics polling lead at this point. And for 2008, 2012, 2016, it was right around 1.5 points for the Democrat. And I think Biden was up by 8.1 points. So a pretty significant gap, even though Trump is the incumbent president. There's the whole rally around the flag thing. The economy had been perceived to be doing well up until just a couple of months ago. So it seems impossible to say exactly how this is going to go, but this is certainly nothing about this is what Donald Trump was hoping 2020 would look like.
No, and at a time when you would rally around the flag, which is at a time of national crisis, which predating George Floyd during Corona, he got a zero sustained rally around the flag. People did not come and rally around the president after a while, and that was really hurtful to their chances. The other part of it is forgetting the poll numbers. Where do you go if you're Donald Trump? What states do you campaign in? Now he's down farther by more in Wisconsin than even in Arizona. Do you go to Arizona, where the Senate campaign's up by 13, Mark Kelly on top of Martha McSally, or do you go to Wisconsin and try and win that back? Are you precarious enough in Ohio and Florida that you have to camp out there constantly and then lose Wisconsin and Arizona? It's, you know, if you're running Trump's campaign, that's what becomes difficult. Where do you go? Where are those votes? Where are those states? And they're fewer now for Donald Trump to choose from with only 5 months left.
Yeah, he seems, from what I've seen generally in, you know, a sampling of swing states, the gap generally seems to be smaller, which is helpful. But he apparently is doing renewed spending in Ohio. I've seen some indication that they're going to be doing some work in Georgia, which is not what they expected. And you never know about these polls, but there was just another Texas poll, I think yesterday, that had him up by one over Biden in Texas. And I think we all agree that if Texas went blue, then that's just, you know, Pack it up.
Well, that's just it, John. And if you're Donald Trump and you know you're going to lose Michigan and Pennsylvania, that means you've got to go to some other state where you have a chance. Early in the year, before all of this happened, at the end of last year, they were talking about New Mexico and Oregon as places they would spend to try and make up for Michigan and Pennsylvania, try and narrow the gap a little bit. Those are states that are so far off the charts for the president right now that they have to go into these swing states just to hang on to them, and they have to pick something else up. There's nothing the president at this point in time has a chance of picking up, of flipping. So he's got to hold on to the states like Ohio and to the fact that, like you just said, that they're considering even spending a dollar in Georgia tells you exactly where they are now.
Yeah, I mean, we had that 2018 race there that was so close. And on the whole, like, there's still the possibility that he could take, just choose a crisis and take it seriously. Just, you have your pick of several crises. With the whole rally around the flag thing, if he had gone against his worst instincts with coronavirus and had taken it seriously, I think he'd be a lock. There'd be no way to beat him. I think that if he was seen as being a responsible leader, but he wasn't. And now with this, he has another chance to rally around the flag. But what he's decided to do is, rather than unifying and bringing the sides together, even in a shallow way, even in a way that's, you know, blatantly opportunistic, he's not doing that. He's just deploying the military, which means that if, like, you might feel as a regular American, like, well, aren't I supposed to support the military or the cops? But look at what you are being forced to sign on to do that now. You're going to have video coming out every day or two of beatings and tear gassing and all of that. You're going to have to be okay with that to rally around the flag this time. And you know, back in the 60s, 70s, easy. A lot of white Americans are perfectly happy to do that. I'm sure many white conservatives are still fine to do that. But is that an electoral majority? I hope not, at the very least.
Yeah, I hope not too. And it's, you know, it's all hypothetical, and so too is your theory that if he had handled this properly, the point is he doesn't handle Corona properly, and he doesn't handle any crisis in a presidential manner. Had he done so, I don't think he would have been a lock. I just think it would have been closer in swing states. I think before we knew about Corona, I didn't think he was a lock at all. So I think all of it combined with a bad economy makes it a very difficult place for a president to run.
Yeah. If you pay even casual attention to corporate behavior, you might have gathered that they're not necessarily always on your side. And it turns out that historically that has very much been the case. But how bad has it gotten at various points? Well, I'm very excited to welcome to the show now the author of Industrial Strength Denial, 8 Stories of Corporations Defending the Indefensible from the Slave Trade to Climate Change, Barbara Fries. Thank you for joining us on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
Very glad to have you here. It's a fascinating book. You're an author as well as an environmental attorney. And so when you decided to do this book, these profiles of corporations defending what no one should defend, what led to you doing that? And how did you choose the cases you decided to profile?
Well, it started with climate denial. As an environmental attorney, I faced that a lot. And in particular, I worked for the state of Minnesota as an assistant attorney general back in the 1990s. And we had a proceeding here in Minnesota where the coal industry came to testify that we did not have to worry about global warming because it wasn't going to happen. And if it did happen, we would enjoy it. And that all those other scientists who said otherwise were biased. And that was my introduction to this particular issue, both the issue of climate change and the issue of denial. And it got me really fascinated by how people could be so cavalier about denying such danger and really putting the whole world at risk. And I started thinking of it not as a bunch of individuals who have these issues, but as a social phenomenon. And once you start thinking about that, well, in my case, I started thinking, where else has this phenomenon led societies in the past? How have other industries specifically responded to evidence that they were causing harm? And, you know, how far from reality did that take us? And how did societies eventually overcome that if they did? And so I plunged into the history. And I came back with these 8 stories. And one thing that I think was important was I really picked industries where the evidence of harm was very strong, so strong that you really knew there was something else going on here than just reasonable minds differing about the evidence. And I picked stories where the harm was profound, affecting, in all but one case, really millions of people, or threatening environmental catastrophe. And I picked cases where the denial was very sustained and in public. So this wasn't just keeping a secret from the public, but it was actually trying to persuade people of an alternative version of reality, which I think had a lot of consequences in terms of how the public perceives reality and really tried to undermine trust in science, certainly in government and in much of journalism. And I think that is one of the factors that makes it so hard today to have a common sense of what's really going on in the world, particularly climate change.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And I'm glad that you chose your examples carefully. Indisputable harm, and in one, you know, in the first case that you talked about climate change, it's one of ones where we now find out that there are, you know, internal memos dating back to decades ago that oil companies, while they continue to publicly deny that it was going on, that they knew, you know, in some of these cases we're of course not going to have documented evidence that they did not believe what they were pushing. But I am very interested in the psychology of these organizations. Like, it's one thing to say that a corporation is pushing something, but a corporation, of course, is made up of many, many people, some at the top, some not. How do the people at the various levels, how do they sort of maybe rationalize the damage as it becomes increasingly clear that's happening? What are some of the things that you found?
Well, right. Rationalization, of course, is a big part of this. It isn't just denying that a problem exists, but deciding that even if it exists, that you are not responsible, you as a corporation are not responsible for having to solve it. So one common form of rationalization is to argue that the cure would be worse than the disease and that other really bad things would happen if you tried to get the industry to stop this. I opened the book actually with a quote from a tobacco executive who argued that if you didn't smoke, who knows what the hell you'd do? You might beat your wife or drive cars fast. And that was a particularly common kind of rationalization. A lot of times I found that the way they avoided responsibility was just to try to be distracting, to sort of say, well, what about this other bigger problem over here? So when the slave trade was confronted with evidence of the brutality of their industry, and I focused on the British slave trade, where you had a more pure industrial denial because the public didn't know anything about slavery, they came back, the slave lobby came back and said, well, what about all those poor people in Britain who are worse off than our slaves, who have comfy cottages on comfy plantations? So that sort of distraction is a major approach to this. A lot of the rationalizations slip into this kind of tribal mindset where they immediately see their critics as part of an opposing tribe and look to find sinister motives rather than just genuine concern. Very often, you find an industry, when it starts to lose the issue, when it sees the sort of public mood slipping away, claiming that the system is rigged, that this is a lynching, that this is a witch hunt. And I think what happens then is that mindset justifies all kinds of other misbehavior, like using front groups and being very deceptive, because you would feel in that case like you're just trying to, you know, level the playing field.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love that as like sort of a last ditch excuse, when of course many of these industries, the fossil fuel industries, pharmaceuticals, you know, food like producers, have an enormous amount of influence over government, and government policy is crafted in line with what they want. So if the system is biased, it is certainly not biased generally, historically in the United States, in favor of the consumers, at least until the last moment. What I'm curious about is, I know that your examples span a large period of time. Does it seem like anything substantial has changed that makes it a little bit easier to break through some of this misinformation? Perhaps, you know, easier access for scientists to make their findings known, or social media. Is there any reason to believe that we might face a little bit less of this corporate misinformation and denying the clear harm that they're doing in the future?
Boy, I really wish I could say that. I mean, the problem, of course, is that social media is very fragmented. And so while it does make it easier for people to find out about these problems in the first place, or for scientists perhaps to get some of their messages out, it also makes it much easier for the disinformation. And the disinformation tends to be targeted more toward what people want to hear. Mm-hmm. And so that is a problem. Another thing to keep in mind is that the corporations merely have to create doubt. They don't have to persuade you that their product is harmless. They just have to make you doubt what the critics are saying, that it is harmful. And that's enough to create paralysis. So having a very fragmented media landscape, I think, actually makes that harder. Now, I believe we will, in the years ahead, come up with ways to rebuild social trust, come up with more trusted sources within the media landscape that will hopefully solve this fragmentation problem. In the meantime, you know, I think that it's remains a huge problem, and it's going to require us to do everything we can to overcome it.
Well, the first step, it seems, would be information, understanding where we've come from. So appreciate the book that you wrote, everyone. It is Industrial Strength Denial. And this is just scratching the surface of these amazing examples. So everyone definitely take a look at that. And Barbara Freese, we appreciate you joining us on the show today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.